Thank you. Good morning. I was working, you know, with the Office of Smoking and Health CDC. We were working with people from the CARDIA study, which I'm going to be presenting data here. And it was not until, like, mid-data analysis that I found out that they have information about the type of cigarettes that the participants use. You know, they don't have the specific brand, but they have information about if the cigarettes they were smoking were either menthol cigarettes or non-menthol cigarettes. And I said, you know, what a great opportunity with FDA trying to have more and more information to regulate, hopefully, menthol cigarettes. What a great opportunity to try to answer some key questions. One of them is what the title suggests, you know, once a menthol smoker, always a menthol smoker. You can have people who use a type of cigarettes, but they may switch to the other type of cigarettes. Are these people stick kind of for life using the same type of cigarettes, you know, being menthol or non-menthol, or do they switch back and forth? So that's one of the questions we wanted to answer. Other two really important ones that came out of the TPSAC advisory committee and the independent review that FDA did was, do people who smoke menthol cigarettes more likely or less likely to quit than people who smoke non-menthol cigarettes? And another really important aspect is that a lot of people who quit, they relapse. So do people who smoke menthol cigarettes more likely to relapse, come back to smoke again, as compared to people who smoke non-menthol cigarettes? So that's what I decided to do. And these are the co-authors for what is going to become a paper. And they also contributed to this presentation. And myself nor the co-authors have anything to disclose. Okay, so this is the very basic outline of what I'm going to be presenting. You know, obviously a very basic background because it has been already mentioned by the other presenters. The study description, and then what I mentioned, you know, what is the likelihood of switching or sticking to the same type of cigarettes over time or not, and in quitting and relapsing, and then obviously some summary and conclusions. Okay, as you all know, menthol cigarettes are often set as a starter product. Menthol cigarettes are used more by youth, women, African Americans, and other minorities, including Hispanics, Hawaiians, and other minority groups like LGBT, as mentioned before. Menthol cigarettes have been implicated as it's more difficult to quit when you smoke menthol cigarettes. Related to initiation, it has been said that it helps the poison go down smoother, and that's why a higher proportion of kids as opposed to adults smoke mentholated cigarettes. And another thing that has been proposed by some researchers is if do menthol cigarettes allow smokers to take a deeper drags and puff, and that may be one of the reasons why African Americans who prefer mentholated cigarettes, when you look at them and compare it to white smokers, they have higher levels of cotton in their serum, in their blood, as compared to the others, even though they smoke less number of cigarettes per day than whites. So what is the CARDIA study I have been referring to? It's the coronary artery risk development in young adults study. It was developed and designed in the mid-80s, and because it's a cardiovascular type of study, a longitudinal study, they obviously look at risk factors. And we know that, you know, cigarette smoking and tobacco use is a risk factor for cardiovascular diseases. So it started in 1985/1986 with 5,000 blacks and white men and women aged 18 to 30 at baseline. In 1985-86, the participants were between 18 to 30 years of age. And they were randomly selected from three population-based samples, one in Birmingham, Alabama, in Chicago, Illinois, and Minneapolis, Minnesota, and also from one healthcare plan in Oakland, California. So this is a community-based longitudinal study. This is not a representative sample of the whole United States. And the recruitment efforts were made in a way that they tried to have a balanced number of people, at least a baseline, kind of equal numbers of people 18, 24, and 25 to 30 years of age, kind of similar balance of white and blacks, and kind of similar balance between people with high school or less and people with more than a high school education. And as I just mentioned, it collects clinical data. In kind of orange there, that was the question used every time that they do the wave, that they went back and asked questions over 25 years. They always ask, for your current brand of cigarettes, are they menthol or non-menthol? And the answer, yeah, just menthol or non-menthol. So that's how we know at each wave what kind of cigarettes they were using. And also we knew at the very baseline what kind of cigarettes they were using. And it's a face-to-face personal interview with some clinical examinations. And then the follow-up is done annually. Very few questions, but, you know, it's a matter of not losing people to follow up. They try to keep contact with them. 25 years is a long time, and they do it by telephone and cell phone. Okay, this is very basic prevalence at baseline of the population that participated in these studies. And what this is showing is the prevalence of menthol cigarette users in this community-based study. And as you can look, by age, by gender, not so much by race, and then to a certain degree by education, different to the national prevalence of cigarette smokers that smoke menthol, which is between 25 to 30%, as mentioned before. With this community-based population, for the most part, it was more than 50%. You look at 18, 24, 25, 50, more than 50% of them were smoking mentholated cigarettes at baseline. Similar with by sex. And then, as you will have expected, by race, almost 90% of them at baseline were smoking mentholated cigarettes compared to about 28, 30% of whites. Okay, this is a very busy slide, so I will take my time. It's breaking down to the left by age, by gender, and by race. And if you look at each row, it tells you at the beginning in 85 or year zero, what was the prevalence of menthol cigarette smoking at that time. And if you look all the way across to the end, 2010, what was the prevalence of menthol cigarette smoking. And for the most part, it went down either a little bit or, you know, yeah, I think that all of them went down. And that's what you, when you look at cross-sectional data, different to this, which is longitudinal data, this is kind of what you see. The younger the kids, the more likely to smoke mentholated cigarettes. The older they get, the less likely they are. And then this is broken down by education. Those with less than high school, if you look at 1985, the prevalence of menthol cigarette use was 75%. By 2010, it was 78%. So in this case, it went up a little bit. But for the most part, it goes down. Now, this is taken from the International Tobacco Control Longitudinal Study. They all only have looked for 5 years, you know. But you look that when you compare 2005 to 2010, there have been an increase in the United States in menthol cigarette use. And that's kind of what we found with, I'm not going to go back to the others, but if you look at 2005 and 2010, with the cardiac study, there also was kind of an increase during that time. So even though prevalence is different, at least the trend seems to go kind of in the right direction. Okay, to answer the first question of this study, or this presentation, once a menthol smoker, always a menthol smoker. So you have here each bar, you know, at the bottom, it says menthol or non-menthol. That's what they were smoking at baseline in 1985/1986. And what you see is that those who were smoking menthol in 85, 16.3% of them switched one or more times during the period of the study. during the length of the study. So some of them switched twice, or even three or four times. If they switched twice, that means that they switched to non-menthol cigarettes, but then they came back to menthol cigarettes. So overall, 16.3% of menthol smokers at baseline switched one or more times, and 13.2%, not that different, of non-menthol smokers switched one or more times during 25 years. However, that was kind of just, you know, taking one thing into consideration. When you take all their things like age, gender, race, etc., you adjust for other factors, what we found was that people who at baseline were smoking menthol cigarettes were more likely to switch to non-menthol cigarettes than the other way around. So that's taking everything on over 25 years of data, and that's what we found, that people are more likely to go to non-menthol. And that kind of makes sense, because if you look at, and these are our adults, but if you look at kids, how do they start? Like 40%, 48% was cited of them start with menthol, because it's a lot easier, you know, to smoke. And then once they are kind of established smokers, some of them may switch, especially the white kids, may switch more into the non-menthol cigarettes. So that's what we found. Now, another really important question for this presentation and for FDA is that what are the odds of cessation when you look at 25 years of smoking when you are using menthol cigarettes at baseline? And what we found was that overall, there was no difference if you smoke a menthol cigarette versus a non-menthol cigarette in terms of quitting. However, that overall may be true, but it's not true when you look at males only. When we look at males only, as part of all our analysis, we found that males, and when I say males, means white males and black males, they were less likely to quit if they were using menthol cigarettes at baseline. So there's a story here in terms of, you know, public health importance of banning mentholated cigarettes. Males, we found that they are less likely to quit if they were using mentholated cigarettes at baseline. Relapse. We look at before, and remember, this is 25 years. So we followed them for, I don't know, eight times, I believe. And we look at what they were smoking before they quit. Let's say that we are in year 10. And the next time that we look at them was year 15. So year 15, they were not smoking. They said that they were not smoking. But year 10, they were smoking. So what type of cigarettes were they smoking? Menthol or non-mentholated cigarettes? And then they say that in year 2025, the person relapsed, came back to smoking again. So what are the odds that a person that before he quit and then he relapsed again, a person who was smoking a mentholated cigarette, are they more likely or less likely or equally likely to relapse than people who were smoking non-mentholated cigarettes? And we found no difference. So people who were smoking menthol or non-menthol, there was no difference in the relapse. So to summarize my presentation, switching from a menthol to a non-menthol cigarette or vice versa is not a common behavior. Yes, some people do it, about 13 to 16%, but for the vast majority of them, they stick to the type of cigarettes that they were smoking at baseline. Cessation, overall, no difference. However, for males who were smoking mentholated cigarettes, less likely to quit. And relapse, no difference. So conclusion to the first, for the title of the presentation, once a menthol smoker, always a menthol smoker, for the most part, the answer is yes. Now, the key question that we're still asking and we would like, you know, as mentioned before, FDA to act is, will a ban of menthol cigarettes result in a public health improvement given the type of cigarette loyalty that people have? As mentioned before in one of the other presentations, that, you know, a lot of menthol smokers said that if they do not have menthol cigarettes, they will not smoke. So that's really important to have. And we see that most people do not switch from one type of cigarettes to another. So the cardia study was not designed specifically to answer the question about mentholated cigarettes, but we used the information. And maybe some of you, if not all of you, know about the PATH study by the FDA. It's a longitudinal study to try to answer many, many questions. One of them is the menthol question. So good, well-designed studies that are longitudinal as needed to either replicate our results or contradict our results. So, thank you very much.
My name is Erin Tessin. I'm from Wake Forest School of Medicine in North Carolina. And we have a longitudinal study of college students to look at smokeless tobacco use over time. And it's students in North Carolina and Virginia, and we've been collecting data on brands and flavors. So if you have data, I'd be happy to share with you.
Cigarettes like Camel Crush, where you may or may not choose to have it menthol. And it wasn't around when the longitudinal study came on board.
So you're talking about the cardia study? Yeah, again, they were, as I showed, the question was very basic questions, you know, are the type of cigarettes that you're smoking menthol or non-menthol? So they didn't look into other kind of tobacco products. Yeah.
Others? I may have some of the details here a little confused, but when they first started talking about the ban, they discovered that one of the guys actually who worked for the governor went into a convenience store. So in the convenience stores and in bars and things, they were giving away coupons where the pack cost a dollar. It wasn't a dollar off. So it ended up being like $11, $12 coupon. But to get it, you had to give them your name and email information, and you got on their database. And then you received many, many emails and inducements to get on the website, this and that. So you got into their information system. And that's, I think, really what they wanted to do with that coupon. They wanted to get you and then use that to help fight this bill. So there's a lot of different ways they can push back at policy. One is sort of to activate their base, and another is to get a bigger base and try to influence those people to make them feel like they've been screwed, so they need to get something going and be on the side of the industry. Coupons are great, and all the emails are like, we have.
I could just comment on that. I know at the federal level, the FDA takes, they do, from what I understand, read all of the comments they receive, and a lot of them, I imagine, are form letters generated by this. I know quantity isn't the only, you know, I know they don't say, okay, well, we have, you know, 100,000 who wanna keep menthol on the market, and only 50,000 who, you know, or whatever it is, who don't. I think they may take numbers into account, but I know it's not the only thing. So when there's not an open docket right now, but when there is, I think I think it's certainly important for people here, people who know the menthol rates in their communities, to submit comments as well, so that it's not outweighed by both the quantity and quality, such as it is from the other side. And yeah, they do generate those. They keep track of everyone very closely. Like, I've signed up for lists myself too, and you know, the coupons can make a big difference. I've gotten, I mean, this is for purely for research purposes, of course, but just to see what they have. I do sign up for those things, and they use you for like lobbying purposes too. You know, contact your legislator about these tax hikes. So since I signed up for those lists, and when they're telling me to contact my legislator, they're telling me to contact myself. It doesn't work in my case, but it can, I imagine it can be effective in other people's cases.
Hi, I'm Christine Tristman with Morgan State University and the CEASE Project. So I had two questions, and I'm probably only going to remember one of them. The first question was, Dr. You had brought up about the depth of puffing, and I didn't know if there is any research about that, anything that you could address about that, because, you know, for years, I mean, it's been an assumption on my part based on people and what they say. And then the other question was from the Law Center, and it was, with the option that you mentioned about states requiring the tobacco industries to report the amount of marketing that they spend. If you could give an example of anybody who's actually done that, or how one would go about making that happen. Thank you.
Yeah, for the first question, there are few, but there have been some studies. They have done it in different ways. You know, have used different kind of designs, study designs. One has been trying to compare serum cutting in levels. There are a couple of studies out there, and those two found no difference. You know, for those two, even though African Americans tend to have higher cutting in levels in general, but when everything is equal, they found, however, there have been a better design studies, more clinical type of designs, and they have found some difference in which people who smoke mentholated cigarettes tend to inhale deeper. So, you know, a little bit, not a lot of studies, a little bit contradicting each other, but the clinical ones that I believe are the better ones tends to point into a, you know, deeper inhalation with mentholated cigarettes.
On the reporting, examples of reporting laws, I know there's a law requiring some. It's been a while since I've looked at them, so I don't remember the exact details. I know there is a law in Minnesota requiring some reporting, and then they get filed somewhere. I don't know how effective that's been. I believe Massachusetts has a law. Again, I don't know the exact details, but if you send me an email, I could get you the detail to those laws, as well as our publication on it. And nobody's, to my knowledge, has done it in the area of menthol specifically.
I am Lane from UCSF. To answer the question about smokeless tobacco, the colleague who left, I think. We did publish a study earlier this year in tobacco control. Chris Del Nabo at Rutgers led it, looking at the trends in marketing of smokeless tobacco, where, and Lydia was on that study, where the role of mint and wintergreen flavored smokeless tobacco is very important in the smokeless tobacco market. And a lot of the same functions of, you know, flavored smokeless tobacco and mint and wintergreen in terms of youth initiation, I think are analogous to what you see with menthol cigarettes, but it just hasn't been addressed in that way.
I'm Naftali Offen from UCSF, and thank you for that great panel. And I have so much trouble hearing about the FDA regulatory body because I am not at all surprised that they haven't done much, even with the very name, family prevention. Talk about newspeak. What is family doing in that title? My question is, you say that at this point the FDA is quiescent about what they're going to do to regulate. Are we waiting for a particular date? Is there a deadline before they have to take action, before their next inaction, I should say?
No, that's a great question. There is no deadline right now. The last thing that happened was they submitted in what's called an advanced notice of proposed rulemaking. That's regulatory speak for, well, we might do something on this in the future, but we might not. I don't know. Tell us what you think. That's the technical way of describing it. So they had they submitted comments on that, and they timed that with when the independent menthol report came out. So they took comments on that, then they extended the comment period, then the comment period closed, I think, last November, about a year ago. And so that there's no open docket right now. We're just kind of in a holding pattern, I guess. And I agree that it's unfortunate.
I work for CDC, obviously, and I asked exactly the same question you asked when they came to CDC, to talk about CTP, et cetera, et cetera. And it's exactly the same answer. I said, at what point do you have enough information to make a decision? And the answer was exactly that. They don't have a specific, point where would they say, okay, this is it.
Well, it's usually collected at the wholesale level, the tax. So,
the sales taxes.
Yeah, that's. I guess I don't. I don't know. I don't know enough about this. I don't have the details here. I'm pretty sure, though, that the city, the city and state would collect the tax. If there is money being lost, it's the tobacco manufacturer and maybe the retailer that's losing it.
Do you think they already thought of it?
Well, I mean, it's...
Slow on the uptake?
Yeah, I think, in those cases, they've determined that, keeping people hooked through low prices is more cost-effective than any small-term loss they might get from giving out a coupon.
Just
ask.
But her question is a really good example of how we've got to get more creative and look for the loopholes, because they're already out there ahead of us. And this is the type of out-of-the-box type of thinking, even if it doesn't take us any place, that we really need to encourage ourselves and hold ourselves up to. You had a question.
Hi, my name is Olivia Cassidy. I'm from the Rutgers Center for Tobacco Studies. My question is for Dr. Brown. I didn't realize that the National Adult Tobacco Survey has a question about sexual orientation, and I was wondering whether other large studies, national survey studies do, and if you start to look at this issue there. And also, if you have any sense about whether brand loyalty or menthol loyalty is as strong in the LGBT community as it is in other groups, and if there was a menthol ban, could we expect similar levels of complete cessation there, or do you think there would be more likely?
the NAT survey has actually included sexual orientation since that year, so since 2009, 2010. So I think that a lot of national surveys are just beginning to include that information. And as far as brand loyalty, that hasn't been studied in that population, but we do know also that LGBT individuals are more likely to dual use, more likely to use menthol, so it would be important to look at, but unfortunately I'm not sure about brand loyalty.
Yeah, the NATS has been continued. It's in the field right now, and so 12-13, the data is out, also have the same information. And then the National Health Interview Survey, which is the one that CDC uses for adult smoking prevalence, just added a similar question. And there's going to be an MNWR, if it's not thrown by Ebola, in November 28th, the adult smoking prevalence for the United States is supposed to come out, and it will have information about sexual orientation.
I'm Chris Bostic from National Smoking and Health, and also with the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. And this question is probably targeted to Mike, but I'll try to speak again. But maybe other panelists have something on it too. We've talked about national, we've talked about state and local. I was wondering if you have any information on what other countries in the world are doing about menthol, and whether there's any examples that can be brought here from the U.S.
Sure. Some other countries are. Brazil has taken action on it. I think there's an EU directive related to menthol. There's been an ongoing trade dispute between the United States over the menthol exemption, because when we prohibited flavors, we prohibited. I'm saying we. When the United States prohibited flavors, it exempted menthol, but it applied to flavors like cloves, which are sold in other countries, and so. I think it was Indonesia challenged that decision and said that it's giving the U.S. market an unfair advantage, and the trade court agreed. And I think there was a penalty issued against the United States for that. I mean, to me, the easy way to solve that would be for the United States to ban menthol as well, and treat all flavors consistently.